group of Sir Amory's guards sat around a scarred wooden table, talking and playing at tiles. Heavy iron bars separated them from where the captives were crowded together in the dark. The smell of the broth brought many up to the bars. Arya counted 8 guards. They smelled the broth as well.
"There is the ugliest serving wench I ever saw," their captain said of Rorg. "What's in the kettle?"
"Your cock and balls. You want to eat or not?"
One of the guards had been pacing, one standing near the bars, a third sitting on the floor with his back to the wall. But the prospect of food drew all of them to the table.
"About bloody time they fed us. That onions I smell. So where's the bread?"
"Fuck, we need bowls, cups, spoons."
"No, you don't."
Rorg heaved the scalding hot broth across the table, full in their faces. Jakin Hagar did the same. Biter threw his kettles too, swinging them underarm so they spun across the dungeon, raining soup. One caught the captain in the temple as he tried to rise. He went down like a sack of sand and lay still. The rest were screaming in agony, praying or trying to crawl off. Arya pressed back against the wall as Rorg began to cut throats. Biter preferred to grab the men behind the head and under the chin and crack their necks with a single twist of his huge, pale hands. Only one of the guards managed to get a blade out. Jakin danced away from his slash, drew his own sword, drove the man back into a corner with a flurry of blows, and killed him with a thrust to the heart. The Larathi brought the blade to Arya, still red with heart's blood, and wiped it clean on the front of her shift.
"A girl should be bloody too. This is her work."
The key to the cell hung from a hook on the wall above the table. Rorg took it down and opened the door. The first man through was the lord with a mailed fist on his surcoat.
"Well done," he said. "I am Robert Glover."
"My lord," Jakin gave him a bow.
Once freed, the captives stripped the dead guards of their weapons and darted up the steps with steel in hand. Their fellows crowded after them, barehanded. They went swiftly and with scarcely a word. None of them seemed quite so badly wounded as they had when Varga Hoat had marched them through the gates of Harrenhal.
"This is the soup. That was clever," the man Glover was saying. "I did not expect that. Was it Lord Hoat's idea?"
Rorg began to laugh. He laughed so loud that snot flew out of the hole where his nose had been. Biter sat on top of one of the dead men, holding a limp hand as he gnawed at the fingers. Bones cracked between his teeth.
"Who are you men?"
A crease appeared between Robert Glover's brows.
"You were not with Hoat when he came to Lord Bolton's encampment. Are you of the Brave Companions?"
Rorg wiped the snot off his chin with the back of his hand.
"We are now."
"This man has the honor to be Jakin Hagar, once of the Free City of Larath. This man's discourteous companions are named Rorg and Biter. A lord will know which is Biter."
He waved a hand towards Arya.
"And here..."
"I'm Weasel," she blurted, before he could tell who she really was. She did not want her name said here, where Rorg might hear, and Biter, and all these others she did not know. She saw Glover dismiss her.
"Very well," he said. "Let's make an end of this bloody business."
When they climbed back up the winding stair, they found the door guards lying in pools of their own blood. Northmen were running across the ward. Arya heard shouts. The door of Barracks Hall burst open, and a wounded man staggered out screaming. 3 others ran after him and silenced him with spear and sword. There was fighting around the gatehouse as well. Rorg and Biter rushed off with Glover, but Jakin Hagar knelt beside Arya.
"A girl does not understand."
"Yes, I do," she said, though she didn't, not truly. The Larathi must have seen it on her face.
"A goat has no loyalty. Soon a wolf banner is raised here, I think. But first, a man would hear a certain name unsaid."
"I take back the name." Arya chewed her lip.
Do I still have a third death? A girl is greedy. Jakin touched one of the dead guards and showed her his bloody fingers. Here is three, and here is four, and eight more lie dead below. The debt is paid.
The debt is paid. Arya agreed reluctantly. She felt a little sad. Now she was just a mouse again.
A god has his due. And now, a man must die.
A strange smile touched the lips of Jaqen H'ghar.
Die? She said, confused. What did he mean?
But I unsaid the name.
You don't need to die now. I do. My time is done.
Jaqen passed a hand down his face, from forehead to chin, and where it went, he changed. His cheeks grew fuller, his eyes closer, his nose hooked. A scar appeared on his right cheek where no scar had been before. And when he shook his head, his long, straight hair, half red and half white, dissolved away to reveal a cap of tight black curls. Arya's mouth hung open.
Who are you?
She whispered, too astonished to be afraid.
How did you do that?
Was it hard? He grinned, revealing a shiny gold tooth.
No harder than taking a new name, if you know the way.
Show me, she blurted. I want to do it too.
If you would learn, you must come with me.
Arya grew hesitant.
Where? Far and away, across the narrow sea.
I can't. I have to go home to Winterfell.
Then we must part, he said, for I have duties too.
He lifted her hand and pressed a small coin into her palm.
Here.
What is it?
A coin of great value.
Arya bit it. It was so hard it could only be iron. Is it worth enough to buy a horse?
It is not meant for the buying of horses.
Then what good is it?
As well ask, what good is life? What good is death? If the day comes when you would find me again, give that coin to any man from Braavos and say these words to him. Velar Morghulis.
Velar Morghulis? Arya repeated. It wasn't hard. Her fingers closed tight over the coin. Across the yard, she could hear men dying. Please, don't go, Jaqen.
Jaqen is as dead as Harry, he said sadly. And I have promises to keep. Velar Morghulis, Arya Stark. Say it again.
Velar Morghulis, she said once more. And the stranger, in Jaqen's clothes, bowed to her and stalked off through the darkness, cloak swirling. She was alone with the dead men. They deserved to die, Arya told herself, remembering all those Sir Aemery Lorch had killed in the Holdfast by the lake. The cellars under King's Pyre were empty when she returned to her bed of straw. She whispered her names to her pillow, and when she was done, she added, Velar Morghulis, in a small, soft voice, wondering what it meant. Come dawn, Pink Eye and the others were back, all but one boy who'd been killed in the fighting for no reason that anyone could say. Pink Eye went up alone to see how matters stood by light of day, complaining all the while that his old bones could not abide steps. When he returned, he told them that Harrenhal had been taken.
Them bloody mummers killed some of Sir Aemery's lot in their beds, and the rest at table after they were good and drunk. The new lord will be here before the day's out with his whole host. He's from the wild north up where that wall is, and they say he's a hard one. This lord or that lord, there's still work to be done. Any foolery and I'll whip the skin off your back.
He looked at Arya when he said that, but never said a word to her about where she had been the night before. All morning she watched the bloody mummers strip the dead of their valuables and drag the corpses to the Flowstone Yard, where a pyre was laid to dispose of them. Shagwell the Fool hacked the heads off two dead knights and pranced about the castle, swinging them by the hair and making them talk.
"What did you die of?"
one head asked.
"Hot weasel soup," replied the second.
Arya was set to mopping up dried blood. No one said a word to her beyond the usual, but every so often she would notice people looking at her strangely. Robert Glover and the other men they'd freed must have talked about what had happened down in the dungeon, and then Shagwell and his stupid talking heads started in about the weasel soup. She would have told him to shut up, but she was scared to. The fool was half mad, and she'd heard that he'd once killed a man for not laughing at one of his japes. "He'd better shut his mouth, or I'll put him on my list with the rest," she thought, as she scrubbed at a reddish-brown stain. It was almost evenfall when the new master of Harrenhal arrived. He had a plain face, beardless, and ordinary, notable only for his queer, pale eyes. Neither plump, thin, nor muscular, he wore black ringmail and a spotted pink cloak. The sigil on his banner looked like a man dipped in blood.
"On your knees, for the Lord of the Dreadfort," shouted his squire, a boy no older than Arya,
and Harrenhal knelt. Vargo Hoat came forward.
"My lord, Harrenhal Ithjorth,"
the lord gave answer, but too softly for Arya to hear. Robert Glover and Sir Aenys Frey, freshly bathed and clad in clean new doublets and cloaks, came up to join them. After some brief talk, Sir Aenys led them over to Rorg and Biter. Arya was surprised to see them still here. Somehow she would have expected them to vanish when Jaqen did. Arya heard the harsh sound of Rorg's voice, but not what he was saying. Then Shagwell pounced on her, dragging her out across the yard.
"My lord, my lord," he sang, tugging at her wrist. "Here's the weasel who made the soup."
"Let go," Arya said, wriggling out of his grasp. The lord regarded her. Only his eyes moved. They were very pale, the color of ice. "How old are you, child?" She had to think for a moment to remember.
10.
10, my lord," he reminded her. "Are you fond of animals?"
"Some kinds, my lord."
A thin smile twitched across his lips. "But not lions, it would seem. Nor manticores." She did not know what to say to that, so she said nothing.
"They tell me you're called Weasel."
"That will not serve. What name did your mother give you?" She bit her lip, groping for another name. Lummy had called her Lumpyhead. Sansa used Horseface. And her father's men once dubbed her Arya Underfoot. But she did not think any of those were the sort of names he wanted.
"Nymeria," she said. "Only she call me Nan for short."
"You will call me my lord when you speak to me, Nan," the lord said mildly. "You are too young to be a brave companion, I think, and of the wrong sex. Are you afraid of leeches, child?"
"They're only leeches, my lord."
"My squire could take a lesson from you, it would seem. Frequent leechings are the secret of a long life. A man must purge himself of bad blood. You will do, I think. For so long as I remain at Harrenhal, Nan, you shall be my cupbearer and serve me at table and in my chambers." This time she knew better than to say she'd sooner work in the stables.
"Yes, your lord. I mean, my lord."
The lord waved a hand.
"Make her presentable," he said to no one in particular, "and make certain she knows how to pour wine without spilling it."
Turning away, he lifted a hand and said,
"Lord Hoat, see to those banners above the gatehouse."
Four brave companions climbed to the ramparts and hauled down the line of Lannister and Sir Aemry's own black manticore. In their place, they raised the flayed man of the Dreadfort and the dire wolf of Stark. And that evening, a page named Nan poured wine for Roose Bolton and Vargo Hoat as they stood on the gallery watching the brave companions parade Sir Aemry Lorch naked through the middle ward. Sir Aemry pleaded and subbed and clung to the legs of his captors, until Rorg pulled him loose and Shagwell kicked him down into the bear pit. The bear is all in black, Arya thought, like Yorin. She filled Roose Bolton's cup and did not spill a drop. Daenerys. In this city of splendors, Dany had expected the House of the Undying Ones to be the most splendid of all. But she emerged from her palanquin to behold a gray and ancient ruin. Long and low, without towers or windows, it coiled like a stone serpent through a grove of black-barked trees whose inky blue leaves made the stuff of the sorcerous drink the Carthene called Shade of the Evening. No other building stood near. Black tiles covered the palace roof, many fallen or broken. The mortar between the stones was dry and crumbling. She understood now why Zarrow, Zoan, Daxus called it the Palace of Dust. Even Drogon seemed disquieted by the sight of it. The black dragon hissed, smoke seeping out between his sharp teeth.
Blood of my blood, Jogo said in Dothraki. This is an evil place, a haunt of ghosts and magi. See how it drinks the morning sun. Let us go before it drinks us as well.
Sir Jorah Mormont came up beside them.
What power can they have if they live in that?
Heed the wisdom of those who love you best, said Zarrow Zoan Daxus, lounging inside the palanquin. Warlocks are bitter creatures who eat dust and drink of shadows. They will give you naught. They have naught to give.
Aego put a hand on his arrack.
Khaleesi, it is said that many go into the Palace of Dust, but few come out.
It is said, Jogo agreed.
We are blood of your blood, said Aego, sworn to live and die as you do. Let us walk with you in this dark place to keep you safe from harm.
Some places even a carl must walk alone, Dany said.
Take me then, Sir Jorah urged. The risk.
Queen Daenerys must enter alone or not at all.
The warlock Pyat Pree stepped out from under the trees.
Has he been there all along? Dany wondered.
Should she turn away now, the doors of wisdom shall be closed to her forevermore.
My pleasure, barge, awaits you even now,
Zarrow, Zoan, Daxus called out.
Turn away from this folly, most stubborn of queens. I have Flotis, who will soothe your troubled soul with sweet music, and the small girl whose tongue will make you sigh and melt.
Sir Jorah Mormont gave the merchant prince a sour look.
Your Grace, remember Mirra Marsdour?
I do, Dany said, suddenly decided. I remember that she had knowledge, and she was only a magi.
Pyat Pree smiled thinly.
The child speaks as sagely as a crone. Take my arm, and let me lead you.
I am no child. Dany took his arm nonetheless. It was darker than she would have thought under the black trees, and the way was longer. Though the path seemed to run straight from the street to the door of the palace, Pyat Pree soon turned aside. When she questioned him, the warlock said only,
The front way leads in, but never out again. Heed my words, my queen. The House of the Undying Ones was not made for mortal men. If you value your soul, take care and do just as I tell you.
I will do as you say, Dany promised.
When you enter, you will find yourself in a room with four doors. The one you have come through and three others. Take the door to the right. Each time, the door to your right. If you should come upon a stairwell, climb. Never go down. And never take any door but the first door to your right.
The door to my right, Dany repeated. I understand. And when I leave, the opposite?
By no means, Pyat Pree said. Leaving and coming, it is the same. Always up, always the door to your right. Other doors may open to you. Within you will see many things that disturb you. visions of loveliness and visions of horror, wonders and terrors, sights and sounds of days gone by and days to come and days that never were. Dwellers and servitors may speak to you as you go. Answer or ignore them as you choose, but enter no room until you reach the audience chamber.
I understand.
When you come to the chamber of the undying, be patient. Our little lives are no more than a flicker of a moth's wing to them. Listen well and write every word upon your heart.
When they reached the door, a tall oval mouth set in a wall fashioned in the likeness of a human face. The smallest dwarf Danny had ever seen was waiting on the threshold. He stood no higher than her knee, his face pinched and pointed, snoutish, but he was dressed in delicate livery of purple and blue, and his tiny pink hands held a silver tray. Upon it rested a slender crystal glass filled with a thick blue liquid, shade of the evening, the wine of warlocks.
Take and drink,
urged Pyat Pree. Will it turn my lips blue?
One flute will serve only to unstop your ears and dissolve the call from off your eyes, so that you may hear and see the truth that will be laid before you.
Danny raised the glass to her lips. The first sip tasted like ink and spoiled meat, foul. But when she swallowed it, it seemed to come to life within her. She could feel tendrils spreading through her chest like fingers of fire coiling around her heart. And on her tongue was a taste like honey and anise and cream, like mother's milk and Drogo's seed, like red meat and hot blood and molten gold. It was all the tastes she had ever known, and none of them. And then the glass was empty.
Now you may enter,
said the warlock. Danny put the glass back on the servitor's tray and went inside. She found herself in a stone anteroom with four doors, one on each wall. With never a hesitation, she went to the door on the right and stepped through. The second room was a twin to the first. Again she turned to the right-hand door. When she pushed it open, she faced yet another small antechamber with four doors. I am in the presence of sorcery. The fourth room was oval rather than square, and walled in worm-eaten wood in place of stone. Six passages led out from it in place of four. Danny chose the rightmost and entered a long, dim, high-ceilinged hall. Along the right hand was a row of torches burning with a smoky orange light. But the only doors were to her left. Drogon unfolded wide black wings and beat the stale air. He flew 20 feet before thudding to an undignified crash. Danny strode after him. The mold-eaten carpet under her feet had once been gorgeously colored, and whorls of gold could still be seen in the fabric, glinting broken amidst the faded gray and mottled green. What remained served to muffle her footfalls, but that was not all to the good. Danny could hear sounds within the walls, a faint scurrying and scrabbling that made her think of rats. Drogon heard them too. His head moved as he followed the sounds, and when they stopped he gave an angry scream. Other sounds, even more disturbing, came through some of the closed doors. One shook and thumped, as if someone was trying to break through. From another came a dissonant piping that made the dragon lash his tail wildly from side to side. Danny hurried quickly past. Not all the doors were closed. I will not look, Danny told herself, but the temptation was too strong. In one room, a beautiful woman sprawled naked on the floor while four little men crawled over her. They had rattish, pointed faces and tiny pink hands, like the servitor who had brought her the glass of shade. One was pumping between her thighs, another savaged her breasts, worrying at the nipples with his wet red mouth, tearing and chewing. Farther on she came upon a feast of corpses. Savagely slaughtered, the feasters lay strewn across overturned chairs and hacked trestle tables, a sprawl in pools of congealing blood. Some had lost limbs, even heads. Severed hands clutched bloody cups, wooden spoons, roast fowl, heels of bread. In a throne above them sat a dead man with the head of a wolf. He wore an iron crown and held a leg of lamb in one hand as a king might hold a scepter, and his eyes followed Danny with mute appeal. She fled from him, but only as far as the next open door. I know this room, she thought. She remembered those great wooden beams and the carved animal faces that adorned them. And there, outside the window, a lemon tree. The sight of it made her heart ache with longing. It is the house with the red door, the house in Braavos. No sooner had she thought of it than old Sir Willem came into the room, leaning heavily on his stick.
Little princess, there you are,
he said in his gruff, kind voice.
Come, he said. Come to me, my lady. You're home now. You're safe now.
His big, wrinkled hand reached for her, soft as old leather, and Danny wanted to take it and hold it and kiss it. She wanted that as much as she had ever wanted anything. Her foot edged forward, and then she thought, he's dead. He's dead, the sweet old bear. He died a long time ago. She backed away and ran. The long hall went on and on and on, with endless doors to her left and only torches to her right. She ran past more doors than she could count, closed doors and open ones, doors of wood and doors of iron, carved doors and plain ones, doors with pulls and doors with locks and doors with knockers. Drogon lashed against her back, urging her on, and Danny ran until she could run no more. Finally, a great pair of bronze doors appeared to her left, grander than the rest. They swung open as she neared, and she had to stop and look. Beyond loomed a cavernous stone hall, the largest she had ever seen. The skulls of dead dragons looked down from its walls. Upon a towering barbed throne sat an old man in rich robes, an old man with dark eyes and long silvery grey hair.
Let him be king over charred bones and cooked meat, he said to a man below him. Let him be the king of ashes.
Drogon shrieked, his claws digging through silk and skin. But the king on the throne never heard, and Danny moved on. Viserys was her first thought the next time she paused, but a second glance told her otherwise. The man had her brother's hair, but he was taller, and his eyes were a dark indigo rather than lilac.
Aegon,
he told a woman, nursing a newborn babe in a great wooden bed.
What better name for a king?
Will you make a song for him? The woman asked.
He has a song, the man replied. He is the prince that was promised, and his is the song of ice and fire.
He looked up when he said it, and his eyes met Danny's, and it seemed as if he saw her standing there beyond the door.
There must be one more, he said,
though whether he was speaking to her or the woman in the bed, she could not say.
The dragon has three heads.
He went to the window seat, picked up a harp, and ran his fingers lightly over its silvery strings. Sweet sadness filled the room as man and wife and babe faded like the morning mist, only the music lingering behind to speed her on her way. It seemed as though she had walked for another hour before the long hall finally ended in a steep stone stair, descending into darkness. Every door, open or closed, had been to her left. Danny looked back behind her. The torches were going out, she realized with a start of fear. Perhaps 20 still burned, 30 at most. One more guttered out, even as she watched, and the darkness came a little farther down the hall, creeping toward her. And as she listened, it seemed as if she heard something else coming, shuffling and dragging itself slowly along the faded carpet. Terror filled her. She could not go back, and she was afraid to stay here. But how could she go on? There was no door on her right, and the steps went down, not up. Yet another torch went out as she stood pondering, and the sounds grew faintly louder. Drogon's long neck snaked out, and he opened his mouth to scream, steam rising from between his teeth.
He hears it too. Danny turned to the blank wall once more, but there was nothing. Could there be a secret door, a door I cannot see? Another torch went out. Another. The first door on the right, he said. Always the first door on the right. The first door on the right. It came to her suddenly. Is the last door on the left? She flung herself through. Beyond was another small room with four doors. To the right she went, and to the right, 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 until she was dizzy and out of breath once more. When she stopped, she found herself in yet another dank stone chamber. But this time the door opposite was round, shaped like an open mouth, and Piet Pree stood outside in the grass beneath the trees.
"Can it be that the undying are done with you so soon?"
he asked in disbelief when he saw her. "So soon?" she said, confused. "I've walked for hours and still not found them."
"You have taken a wrong turning. Come, I will lead you."
Piet Pree held out his hand. Danny hesitated. There was a door to her right, still closed.
"That's not the way,"
Piet Pree said firmly, his blue lips prim with disapproval.
"The undying ones will not wait forever.
Our little lives are no more than a flicker of a moth's wing to them," Danny said, remembering.
"Stubborn child, you will be lost and never found."
She walked away from him to the door on the right.
"No!"
Piet screeched.
"No, to me, come to me, to me!"
His face crumbled inward, changing to something pale and worm-like. Danny left him behind, entering a stairwell. She began to climb. Before long, her legs were aching. She recalled that the House of the Undying Ones had seemed to have no towers. Finally, the stair opened. To her right, a set of wide wooden doors had been thrown open. They were fashioned of ebony and weirwood, the black and white grains swirling and twisting in strange interwoven patterns. They were very beautiful, yet somehow frightening. The blood of the dragon must not be afraid. Danny said a quick prayer, begging the warrior for courage and the Dothraki horse guard for strength. She made herself walk forward. Beyond the doors was a great hall and a splendor of wizards. Some wore sumptuous robes of ermine, ruby, velvet, and cloth of gold. Others fancied elaborate armor studded with gemstones, or tall, pointed hats speckled with stars. There were women among them, dressed in gowns of surpassing loveliness. Shafts of sunlight slanted through the windows of stained glass, and the air was alive with the most beautiful music she had ever heard. A kingly man in rich robes rose when he saw her and smiled.
"Daenerys of House Targaryen, be welcome. Come and share the food of forever. We are the Undying of Kaas."
"Long have we awaited you," said a woman beside him, clad in rose and silver. The breast she had left bare in the Carthene fashion was as perfect as a breast could be.
"We knew you were to come to us," the Wizard King said. "A thousand years ago we knew, and we have been waiting all this time. We sent the comet to show you the way."
"We have knowledge to share with you," said a warrior in shining emerald armor, "and magic weapons to arm you with. You have passed every trial. Now come and sit with us, and all your questions shall be answered." She took a step forward. But then Drogon leapt from her shoulder. He flew to the top of the ebony and weirwood door, perched there, and began to bite at the carved wood.
"A willful beast," laughed a handsome young man. "Shall we teach you the secret speech of dragonkind? Come, come."
Doubt seized her. The great door was so heavy, it took all of Danny's strength to budge it. But finally, it began to move. Behind was another door. Hidden. It was old grey wood, splintery and plain, but it stood to the right of the door through which she'd entered. The wizards were beckoning her with voices sweeter than song. She ran from them, Drogon flying back down to her. Through the narrow door she passed into a chamber
awash in gloom. A long stone table filled this room. Above it floated a human heart, swollen and blue with corruption, yet still alive. It beat, a deep, ponderous throb of sound, and each pulse sent out a wash of indigo light. The figures around the table were no more than blue shadows. As Danny walked to the empty chair at the foot of the table, they did not stir, nor speak, nor turn to face her. There was no sound but the slow, deep beat of the rotting heart.
"Mother of dragons,"
came a voice, part whisper and part moan.
"Dragons, dragons, dragons."
Other voices echoed in the gloom. Some were male and some female. One spoke with the timbre of a child. The floating heart pulsed from dimness to darkness. It was hard to summon the will to speak, to recall the words she had practiced so assiduously. "I am Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen, Queen of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros. Do they hear me? Why don't they move?" She sat, folding her hands in her lap. "Grant me your counsel, and speak to me with the wisdom of those who have conquered death." Through the indigo murk, she can make out the wizened features of the Undying One to her right, an old, old man, wrinkled and hairless. His flesh was a ripe violet blue, his lips and nails bluer still, so dark they were almost black. Even the whites of his eyes were blue. They stared unseeing at the ancient woman on the opposite side of the table, whose gown of pale silk had rotted on her body. One withered breast was left bare in the Carthene manner, to show a pointed blue nipple hard as leather. "She is not breathing." Danny listened to the silence. "None of them are breathing. They do not move. And those eyes see nothing. Could it be that the Undying Ones were dead?" Her answer was a whisper, as thin as a mouse's whisker.
"We live, live, live,"
it sounded. Myriad other voices whispered echoes.
"And no, 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 no."
"I have come for the gift of truth," Danny said. "In the long hall, the things I saw, were they true visions or lies? Past things or things to come? What did they mean?"
"The shape of shadows. Morrows not yet made. Drink from the cup of ice. Drink from the cup of fire. Mother of dragons. Child of three."
"Three?" She did not understand.
"Three heads has the dragon."
The ghost chorus yammered inside her skull with never a lip moving, never a breath stirring the still blue air.
"Mother of dragons, child of storm."
The whispers became a swirling song.
"Three fires must you light, one for life and one for death and one to love."
Her own heart was beating in unison with the one that floated before her, blue and corrupt.
"3 months must you ride, one to bed, one to dread, and one to love."
The voices were growing louder, she realized, and it seemed her heart was slowing, and even her breath.
"3 treasons you will know, once for blood, and once for gold, and once for love."
"I don't." Her voice was no more than a whisper, almost as faint as theirs. What was happening to her? "I don't understand," she said more loudly. "Why was it so hard to talk here? Help me. Show me."
"Help her,"
the whispers mocked.
"Show her."
Then phantoms shivered through the murk, images in indigo. Viserys screamed as the molten gold ran down his cheeks and filled his mouth. A tall lord with copper skin and silver-gold hair stood beneath the banner of a fiery stallion, a burning city behind him. Rubies flew like drops of blood from the chest of a dying prince.
and he sank to his knees in the water and with his last breath murmured a woman's name.
Mother of dragons, daughter of death.
Glowing like sunset, a red sword was raised in the hand of a blue-eyed king who cast no shadow. A cloth dragon swayed on poles amidst a cheering crowd. From a smoking tower, a great stone beast took wing, breathing shadow fire.
Mother of dragons, slayer of lies.
Her silver was trotting through the grass to a darkling stream beneath a sea of stars. A corpse stood at the prow of a ship, eyes bright in his dead face, grey lips smiling sadly. A blue flower grew from a chink in a wall of ice and filled the air with sweetness.
Mother of dragons, bride of fire.
Faster and faster the visions came, one after the other, until it seemed as if the very air had come alive. Shadows whirled and danced inside a tent, boneless and terrible. A little girl ran barefoot toward a big house with a red door. Mira Ma's door shrieked in the flames, a dragon bursting from her brow. Behind a silver horse, the bloody corpse of a naked man bounced and dragged. A white lion ran through the grass, taller than a man. Beneath the Mother of Mountains, a line of naked crones crept from a great lake and knelt shivering before her, their grey heads bowed. 10,000 slaves lifted blood-stained hands as she raced by on her silver, riding like the wind.
Mother! They cried. Mother! Mother!
They were reaching for her, touching her, tugging at her cloak, the hem of her skirt, her foot, her leg, her breast. They wanted her, needed her, the fire, the life. And Danny gasped and opened her arms to give herself to them. But then black wings buffeted her round the head, and a scream of fury cut the indigo air, and suddenly the visions were gone, ripped away, and Danny's gasp turned to horror. The undying were all around her, blue and cold, whispering as they reached for her, pulling, stroking, tugging at her clothes, touching her with their dry, cold hands, twining their fingers through her hair. All the strength had left her limbs. She could not move. Even her heart had ceased to beat. She felt a hand on her bare breast, twisting her nipple. Teeth found the soft skin of her throat. Her mouth descended on one eye, licking, sucking, biting. Then indigo turned to orange, and whispers turned to screams. Her heart was pounding, racing. The hands and mouths were gone. Heat washed over her skin, and Danny blinked at a sudden glare. Perched above her, the dragon spread his wings and tore at the terrible dark heart, ripping the rotten flesh to ribbons. And when his head snapped forward, fire flew from his open jaws, bright and hot. She could hear the shrieks of the undying as they burned, their high, thin, papery voices crying out in tongues long dead. Their flesh was crumbling parchment, their bones dry wood soaked in tallow. They danced as the flames consumed them. They staggered and writhed and spun and raised blazing hands on high, their fingers bright as torches. Danny pushed herself to her feet and bowled through them. They were light as air, no more than husks, and they fell at a touch. The whole room was ablaze by the time she reached the door.
Drogon,
she called. And he flew to her through the fire. Outside, a long, dim passageway stretched serpentine before her, lit by the flickering orange glare from behind. Danny ran, searching for a door to her right, a door to her left, any door. But there was nothing, only twisty stone walls and a floor that seemed to move slowly under her feet, writhing as if to trip her. She kept her feet and ran faster, and suddenly the door was there ahead of her, a door like an open mouth. When she spilled out into the sun, the bright light made her stumble. Piat Pri was gibbering in some unknown tongue and hopping from one foot to the other. When Danny looked behind her, she saw thin tendrils of smoke forcing their way through cracks in the ancient stone walls of the Palace of Dust.
and rising from between the black tiles of the roof. Howling curses, Pyat Pree drew a knife and danced toward her. But Drogon flew at his face. Then she heard the crack of Jogo's whip, and never was a sound so sweet. The knife went flying, and an instant later, Recaro was slamming Pyat to the ground. Sir Jorah Mormont knelt beside Dany in the cool green grass and put his arm around her shoulder. Tyrion. If you die stupidly, I am going to feed your body to the goats, Tyrion threatened as the first load of stone crows pushed off from the quay. Shagger laughed.
The half-man has no goats.
I'll get some just for you. Dawn was breaking, and pale ripples of light shimmered on the surface of the river, chattering under the poles and reforming when the ferry had passed. Timmet had taken his burn men into the King's Wood 2 days before. Yesterday the Black Ears and Moon Brothers followed. Today the Stone Crows. Whatever you do, don't try and fight a battle, Tyrion said. Strike at their camps and baggage train. Ambush their scouts and hang the bodies from trees ahead of their line of march. Loop around and cut down stragglers. I want night attacks, so many and so sudden that they'll be afraid to sleep. Shagger laid a hand atop Tyrion's head. All this how I learn from Dolph, son of Holger, before my beard had grown. This is the way of war in the Mountains of the Moon. The King's Wood is not the Mountains of the Moon, and you won't be fighting milk snakes and painted dogs. And listen to the guides I'm sending. They know this wood as well as you know your mountains. Heed their counsel, and they'll serve you well.
Shagger will listen to the half-man's pets,
the clansman promised solemnly. And then it was time for him to lead his Garen onto the ferry. Tyrion watched them push off and pole out toward the center of the Blackwater. He felt a queer twinge in the pit of his stomach as Shagger faded in the morning mist. He was going to feel naked without his clansmen. He still had bronze hirelings, near 800 of them now, but sellswords were notoriously fickle. Tyrion had done what he could to buy their continued loyalty, promising Bronn and a dozen of his best men lands and knighthoods when the battle was won. They drank his wine, laughed at his jests, and called each other Sir until they were all staggering. All but Bronn himself, who only smiled that insolent dark smile of his, and afterwards said,
"They'll kill for that knighthood, but don't ever think they'll die for it."
Tyrion had no such delusion. The gold cloaks were almost as uncertain a weapon. 6,000 men in the city watch, thanks to Cersei, but only a quarter of them could be relied upon.
There's few out-and-out traitors, though there's some. Even your spider hasn't found them all,
Bywater had warned him.
But there's hundreds, greener than spring grass. Men who join for bread and ale and safety. No man likes to look craven in the sight of his fellows. So they'll fight brave enough at the start, when it's all war horns and blowing banners. But if the battle looks to be going sour, they'll break. And they'll break bad. The first man to throw down his spear and run will have 1,000 more trotting on his heels.
To be sure, there were seasoned men in the City Watch, the core of 2,000, who'd gotten their gold cloaks from Robert, not Cersei. Yet even those, a watchman was not truly a soldier, Lord Tywin Lannister had been fond of saying. Of knights and squires and men-at-arms, Tyrion had no more than 300. Soon enough, he must test the truth of another of his father's sayings. One man on a wall was worth 10 beneath it. Bronn and the escort were waiting at the foot of the quay amid swarming beggars, strolling whores, and fishwives crying the catch. The fishwives did more business than all the rest combined. Buyers flocked around the barrels and stalls to haggle over winkles, clams, and river pike. With no other food coming into the city, the price of fish was 10 times what it had been before the war, and still rising. Those who had coin came to the riverfront each morning and each evening in hopes of bringing home an eel or a pot of red crabs. Those who did not slipped between the stalls, hoping to steal, or stood gaunt and forlorn beneath the walls. The gold cloaks cleared a path through the press, shoving people aside with the shafts of their spears. Tyrion ignored the muttered curses as best he could. A fish came sailing out of the crowd, slimy and rotten. It landed at his feet and flew to pieces. He stepped over it gingerly and climbed into his saddle. Children with swollen bellies were already fighting over pieces of the stinking fish. Mounted, he gazed along the riverfront. Hammers rang in the morning air as carpenters swarmed over the mud gate, extending wooden hoardings from the battlements. Those were coming well. He was a deal less pleased by the clutter of ramshackle structures that had been allowed to grow up behind the quays, attaching themselves to the city walls like barnacles on the hull of a ship. Bait shacks and pot shops, warehouses, merchant stalls, ale houses, the cribs where the cheaper sort of whores spread their legs. It has to go, every bit of it. As it was, Stannis would hardly need scaling ladders to storm the walls. He called Brunn to his side. Assemble 100 men and burn everything you see here between the water's edge and the city walls. He waved his stubby finger, taking in all the waterfront squalor. I want nothing left standing. Do you understand? The black-haired sellsword turned his head, considering the task. Them as own all this won't like that much. I never imagined they would. So be it. They'll have something else to curse the evil monkey demon for. Some may fight. See that they lose. What do we do with those that live here? Let them have a reasonable time to remove their property and move them out. Try not to kill any of them. They're not the enemy. And no more rapes. Keep your men in line, damn it. They are sellswords, not septons, said Bronn. Next, you'll be telling me you want them sober. It couldn't hurt. Tyrion only wished he could as easily make city walls twice as tall and three times as thick. Though perhaps it did not matter. Massive walls and tall towers had not saved Storm's End, nor Harrenhal, nor even Winterfell. He remembered Winterfell as he had last seen it, not as grotesquely huge as Harrenhal, nor as solid and impregnable to look at as Storm's End, yet there had been a great strength in those stones, a sense that within those walls a man might feel safe. The news of the castle's fall had come as a wrenching shock. The guards give with one hand and take with the other, he muttered under his breath when Varys told him. They had given the Starks Harrenhal and taken Winterfell, a dismal exchange. No doubt he should be rejoicing. Robb Stark would have to turn north now. If he could not defend his own home and hearth, he was no sort of king at all. It meant reprieve for the west, for House Lannister, and yet Tyrion had only the vaguest memory of Theon Greyjoy from his time with the Starks. A callow youth, always smiling, skilled with a bow, it was hard to imagine him as Lord of Winterfell. The Lord of Winterfell would always be a Stark. He remembered their gods would, the tall sentinels armored in their grey-green needles, the great oaks, the hawthorn, and ash, and soldier pines, and at the center the heart tree, standing like some pale giant frozen in time. He could almost smell the place, earthy and brooding, the smell of centuries, and he remembered how dark the wood had been even by day. That wood was Winterfell. It was the north. I never felt so out of place as I did when I walked there. So much an unwelcome intruder. He wondered if the Greyjoys would feel it too. The castle might well be theirs, but never that Godswood. Not in a year, or 10, or 50. Tyrion Lannister walked his horse slowly toward the Mudgate. Winterfell is nothing to you, he reminded himself.
Be glad the place has fallen, and look to your own walls.
Gate was open. Inside, three great trebuchets stood side by side in the market square, peering over the battlements like three huge birds. Their throwing arms were made from the trunks of old oaks and banded with iron to keep them from splitting. The gold cloaks had named them the Three Whores, because they'd be giving Lord Stannis such a lusty welcome.
Or so we hope.
Tyrion put his heels into his horse and trotted through the mud gate, breasting the human tide. Once beyond the Whores, the press grew thinner and the street opened up around him. The ride back to the Red Keep was uneventful, but at the Tower of the Hand, he found a dozen angry trader captains waiting in his audience chamber to protest the seizure of their ships. He gave them a sincere apology and promised compensation once the war was done. That did little to appease them.
"What if you should lose, my lord?"
one Bravossi asked.
"Then apply to King Stannis for your compensation."
By the time he rid himself of them, bells were ringing, and Tyrion knew he would be late for the installation. He waddled across the yard almost at a run and crowded into the back of the castle sept as Joffrey fastened white silk cloaks about the shoulders of the two newest members of his king's guard. The rite seemed to require that everyone stand, so Tyrion saw nothing but a wall of courtly arses. On the other hand, once the new High Septon was finished leading the two knights through their solemn vows and anointing them in the names of the Seven, he would be well positioned to be first out of doors. He approved of his sister's choice of Sir Balan Swan to take the place of the slain Preston Greenfield. The Swans were marcher lords, proud, powerful, and cautious. Pleading illness, Lord Gullion Swan had remained in his castle, taking no part in the war. But his elder son had ridden with Renly and now Stannis, while Balon, the younger, served at King's Landing. If he'd had a third son, Tyrion supposed he'd be off with Robb Stark. It was not perhaps the most honourable course, but it showed good sense. Whoever won the Iron Throne, the Swans intended to survive. In addition to being well-born, young Sir Balon was valiant, courtly, and skilled at arms, good with a lance, better with a morning star, superb with a bow. He would serve with honour and courage. Alas, Tyrion could not say the same for Cersei's second choice. Sir Osmond Kettleblack looked formidable enough. He stood 6 feet and 6 inches, most of it sinew and muscle, and his hook nose, bushy eyebrows, and spade-shaped brown beard gave his face a fierce aspect, so long as he did not smile. Low-born, no more than a hedge knight, Kettleblack was utterly dependent on Cersei for his advancement, which was doubtless why she picked him. "Sir Osmond is as loyal as he is brave," she told Joffrey when she put forward his name. It was true, unfortunately. The good Sir Osmond had been selling her secrets to Bronn since the day she hired him, but Tyrion could scarcely tell her that. He supposed he ought not complain. The appointment gave him another ear close to the king, unbeknownst to his sister. And even if Sir Osmond proved an utter craven, he would be no worse than Sir Boris Blunt, currently residing in a dungeon at Rosby. Sir Boris had been escorting Tommen and Lord Giles when Sir Jaslyn Bywater and his gold cloaks had surprised them, and had yielded up his charge with an alacrity that would have enraged old Sir Barristan Selmy as much as it did Cersei. A knight of the King's Guard was supposed to die in defence of the king and royal family. His sister had insisted that Joffrey strip Blunt of his white cloak on the grounds of treason and cowardice.
And now she replaces him with another man just as hollow.
The praying, vowing, and anointing seemed to take most of the morning.
Tyrion's leg soon began to ache. He shifted his weight from one foot to the other, restless.
Lady Tanda stood several rows up, he saw, but her daughter was not with her. He had been half hoping to catch a glimpse of Shay. Varys said she was doing well, but he would prefer to see for himself.
"Better a lady's maid than a pot girl,"
Shay had said, when Tyrion told her the eunuch scheme. "Can I take my belt of silver flowers and my gold collar with the black diamonds you said looked like my eyes? I won't wear them if you